is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A big day at the Supreme Court. Senator Sanders will be with us in just a moment. It's going to be our first hour brunch with Bernie. However, Senator Sanders has generously ceded the first 2 or 3 minutes of the program to our old friend Ellen Ratner, our colleague. We share offices, talk radio news service. We've been friends for forever. And Ellen, you first marched for gay rights. You are
Labor Day 1970, so it's 45 years less 72 days or 74 days, I think. But what's so amazing about that, it would be like being involved in the Voting Rights Act in 1920 and finally seeing it pass. I can't believe it. Of course, I've been married 10 and a half years. Here's my gay heart made by women in South Sudan.
10 and a half years to Sholene Espinosa.
That's right, who's now a doctor. Here's a sign I got in front of the Supreme Court. And there you go. America. And it's amazing. Honestly, I cannot believe we're at this day, and I can't believe that all the people who died of AIDS, unfortunately, who have been involved in this, gay rights, gay marriage, it's today. It's a great day to celebrate. And I also want to just thank Senator Bernie Sanders, who has been there with us every step of the way.
Yeah, there you go. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News. God bless you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you. I'm excited.
Your marriage to Sholene is now legal all across the United States.
Isn't that wonderful? So has all our work in gay rights. Thank you very much.
Isn't that wonderful? Thank you. And Senator Sanders, are you with us?
I am right here.
Hey, so your thoughts?
Well, let me share my congratulations with Ellen and all of those people who for so many years have been advocating for equality in this country and for gay rights. Today is a momentous day for them, and they deserve everything that they have won today. You know, Tom, when I reflect on this issue and so many other issues, what it tells me is that when people come together in large numbers to stand up for dignity and decency and democracy and civil rights, we end up winning. And it doesn't happen overnight. What Ellen just told you is she has been at this work for, what was it?
45 years. Yeah.
And I can tell you, 45 years ago, this was not a particularly popular issue.
Right.
But what happens is that when you stand up and fight and you get your ideas out to the American people, decency often prevails. And that's certainly the case here. And I think you have a Supreme Court that looks around the country and says, you know what? This is the right thing to do. We cannot maintain discriminatory practices in this country. So it's a great day for the civil rights movement, for the gay rights movement, and we applaud all of them for their hard work. But, you know, it reminds me, Tom, there was a poll done in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago, and some of the results were really quite astounding. And it's a similar point to the point that we're talking about now on gay rights. The people of the country in this poll were asked their views on whether or not we should expand Social Security benefits. Now, as you'll remember, a few years ago, all of the discussion was, well, how much should we cut Social Security?
Right.
Should we do a chained CPI and lower cost of living adjustment? Should we raise the retirement age to 123? What should we do? And by overwhelming numbers, people are now saying, oh, no, elderly people are hurting. We need to expand Social Security benefits, and the way you do that is to lift the cap on taxable income, which is now only at $118,000. Huge victory. A few years ago, Tom, if you and I were on the phone, you and I have been long advocates for raising the minimum wage.
Yeah.
And the Democrats in the Congress were very, very courageous and very brave, and they said, well, we're going to go up to $10.10 an hour. Oh, boy. Well, poll asked the American people, what do you think about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour? American people said, yeah, by a pretty good majority.
Yep.
So in other words, what's the point? Whether it is gay rights and gay marriage, whether it is Social Security benefits, whether it is the minimum wage, whether it is asking the wealthy and the powerful to start paying their fair share of taxes, whether it is making sure that every worker in this country has family and medical leave, whether we have pay equity for women workers, whether we create the millions of jobs we need by rebuilding our infrastructure, all of these ideas, which a few years ago were seemingly so very radical ideas, well, you know what? They're mainstream ideas because they're common sense ideas. And when you get the opportunity to talk to the American people, they say, of course. youth unemployment. There was a study that came out a couple of weeks ago by the Economic Policy Institute, which is one of the better think tanks in the country. And we asked them to take a look at real youth unemployment, for those young people 17 to 20 who are unemployed or have given up looking for work or working part-time when they want to work full-time. And the numbers that came back are almost beyond comprehension. For white and Hispanic kids, it is over 30%. For African-American youth, it is over 50%, 51%.
Oh, my.
So these are issues that we have to deal with. And much of the stuff that I talk about, that you talk about, and people say, well, that's great, you're courageous, you're raising this banner high. No, this is kind of common sense, popular ideas that the American people want to see implemented. But what you have in Congress right now is you have a Republican Party, which is pushing the ideology of the Koch brothers and other extreme right-wing billionaires, whose idea of dealing with income and wealth inequality is to give well over $200 billion in tax breaks to the top 0.2% by eliminating the estate tax. Their idea in terms of minimum wage is to do away with the concept of minimum wage, so that in high unemployment areas, you have people working for $3 or $4 an hour. Their concept of jobs is to expand disastrous trade policies so that companies in this country can shut down and move to China and other low-wage countries. That's their idea of how you create jobs. Their idea is of tax reform is to lower taxes for the wealthiest people in this country rather than ask them to stop paying their fair share of taxes. So when you really are able to get out to the American people, instead of wanting to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and education and give tax breaks to the rich and large corporations, what the American people say is exactly the opposite. No, we want to create jobs. We want to raise the minimum wage. We want pay equity for women workers. And we want the wealthy not only not to get more tax breaks, but to, in fact, to start paying their fair share of taxes. So it is very interesting where the American people are on the issues, and increasingly in issues like gay marriage, as opposed to where the Congress is, especially our right-wing Republican colleagues. So today was a great day in terms of marriage equality. I think it's going to transform America. Very important issue. Obviously, today there are at least one funeral in Charleston with regard to that horrendous tragedy, unbelievable, of a guy walking into a Bible study class and after praying or discussing the Bible for an hour, taking out a gun and shooting down 9 innocent people, unspeakable. And the good news is that in the South and elsewhere, there is an understanding that that Confederate flag is, for many people, tragically, a symbol of a racist past being used by a lot of extreme right-wing hate groups. And I think we're making progress in getting that symbol of that Confederate flag and that symbol of racism taking down. But I believe that while obviously we have to do that, what we do have to understand is that economically, the African American community, Hispanic community, has fallen further and further behind in recent years since the Wall Street crash. In terms of the disparity between whites and minorities, that's growing. And we have to address an issue that nobody is talking about, and that is this horrendously high unemployment rate for black and minority youth and white youth as well. And that's why we're working on a major jobs program for our young people. So those are a few of the issues that have been out there this week.
There you go. We'll be back with Senator Sanders. We'll be picking up your calls for Senator Sanders at our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Quick programming note, our second and third hour Sirius XM is going to go live to the funeral in Charleston. We're going to be playing best ofs. If our local affiliates want to carry local programming, go for it. And welcome back. We're live with Senator Bernie Sanders, our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie on this historic day from the Supreme Court. And, Senator, ready to take some calls?
Let's do it.
Okay. Danielle, watching on Free Speech TV in Alpharetta, Georgia. Hey, Daniel. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I recently watched a film about income inequality by Robert Reich, and I was just astounded by the harmful effects of Reaganomics and trickle-down economics. How can we change the economy from trickle-down to a middle-out, one that Robert Reich would prefer, so would the middle class?
Well, Daniel, thanks for that question. Bob Reich has done extraordinary work over the years. I saw that film. In fact, we showed that film all over the state of Vermont and got a very popular response. And here's the issue. What we need to do is to come forward with a progressive economic agenda which says to the American people that if we stand together, we can create economics which grows the middle class, which lowers poverty in America, and which creates millions of decent paying jobs. And let me just very briefly, Daniel, tell you what I think should be in that agenda. Number one, poll after poll always tells us that the issue of real concern to the American people, of most concern, is jobs and the economy. And the way we address that issue most effectively and quickly is through a massive federal jobs program rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, roads, bridges, rail, water systems, levees, dams, older schools, etc. I've introduced legislation that would invest $1 trillion over a five-year period. It would create and maintain some 13 million jobs. So that creating jobs is enormously important. Number two, we got to change our trade policy. I am very disappointed by the vote this week in terms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think it just continues a disastrous trade policy which allows companies to shut down in America and move abroad. And I'll continue my efforts to defeat. Fast Track has passed. I'll continue my efforts to defeat the TPP. It's going to be an uphill fight. We've got to rally the American people. We need a new trade policy which works for workers and not just CEOs. We've got to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, which to my mind is $15 an hour over the next few years. We need pay equity for women workers. Women should not be making 78 cents on the dollar compared to men. We've also got to learn from many European countries that family and medical leave when you have a baby or somebody in the family is sick should be a right, at least 1 month a year off for family and medical leave. Paid sick leave should be a right. Guaranteed vacation time of at least 10 days a year should be a right. So those are some of the ingredients, and there are more, obviously, of what I think is a way to put money into the hands of working people. And when they have that money, they're going to go out and spend that money, and they are going to create more jobs. The level of income and wealth inequality in this country is grotesque, it is unsustainable, and it is not America. One-tenth of 1% now own almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. 99% of all new income today is going to the top 1%. In the last 30 years, we have seen a huge transfer of wealth from the middle class and working families to the very wealthiest people in this country, and that has got to be reversible.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be right back with more of Senator Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back.
On April 15, 1949, Pacifica Radio KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California, went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America. James Baldwin was a prominent and prolific novelist, essayist, and playwright.
The psychology, the sense of reality, which allows any policeman to treat almost any citizen, but particularly any citizen suspected of being odd, strange, hard to handle, as his inferior.
James Baldwin, recorded at the San Francisco Masonic Temple on December 14, 1964, broadcast on Pacifica Radio. Did you know that you can get most any of the 50,000 Pacifica broadcasts in our collection? Visit us online at PacificaRadioArchives.org and help support the Archives' mission to preserve Pacifica's broadcast legacy.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
Welcome back. Senator Sanders with us. A bunch of Bernie hour on this historic day, the Supreme Court ruling in favor of gay marriage. And, Senator, one of our callers from Madison, Wisconsin, called and said that they thought that you were going to be in Madison this coming Wednesday.
I am going to be in Madison, and we are going to be there Wednesday, July 1st at 7 p.m. at the Madison, Wisconsin Veterans Memorial Coliseum. So that's this coming Wednesday, July 1st, 7 p.m. at the Madison Veterans Memorial Coliseum.
And, great.
We look forward to seeing as many people as possible.
Yeah, and we're on the mic 91.2 there in Madison, so for folks listening. Danette, in Hinesville, Georgia, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. First of all, thank you for all the work that you do and for what you're doing just for the country, speaking truth to power. I really appreciate it. My question, or actually it's more of a comment, and I can ask it in the form of a question. Will you be speaking more on your civil rights record? I know that you participated in the March on Washington, and there's a lot of conversation happening in the country surrounding you, and people are just really awful, you know, saying that, you know, what is he going to say about, you know, what's happening with the racial violence and talking up Hillary Clinton for what she said. And I just wondered if you would speak more publicly about your civil rights record and what's happening with black people in America.
Thank you. Jenna, thanks very much for
the question.
And let me start off by saying that I believe that as a nation, we should be proud of the progress that we have made in recent years in terms of civil rights and electing the first African-American president in our history. But anybody who thinks we're anywhere near where we should be in terms of creating a non-discriminatory society is dead wrong. And the issues out there, I think, that we all have seen is whether it is Ferguson or whether it is Baltimore or whether it is tragically in South Carolina, issues of blatant racism, of police brutality, of issues of all over this country where young African Americans are walking down the street and they're being harassed by police officers. That has got to end. And what has got to end is the fact that police departments around this country cannot act as occupying forces. They have to be seen as being part of the community. When I was mayor of the city of Burlington, we moved toward community policing, which does just that. It makes the police department part of a community, not an outside force coming in. And again, as a mayor, I worked with police for 8 years, and most of these people work really hard under very difficult circumstances. Not easy being a cop. But when a police officer breaks the law, when young black people are beaten up or sometimes killed, that is clearly unacceptable, and police officers who commit these crimes must be punished. Furthermore, as I mentioned earlier, when we talk about civil rights, we also have got to understand that poverty and incarceration rates among the African-American community is at levels which are almost incomprehensible. There is a debate exactly about the statistics, Jeanette, but the guess is that today, if we do not change things, the likelihood is that an African-American male baby born today stands a 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 chance of ending up in jail, and that half of young African-Americans will be at some point or another in their lives arrested. Now, what that tells me is that when real unemployment for young African-Americans is over 50%, then maybe it makes a little bit more sense to start investing in education and jobs rather than in more incarceration and more jails. And I feel very strongly about that. You're seeing just a horrendous attack upon a young generation of people, which is an unbelievable human tragedy. So the fight has got to be to create police departments which are well-trained, which reflect the demographics of their communities, We've got to get military equipment out of cities so that police departments are not looked at as occupying forces. But we've also got to address, in addition to all of that, the serious economic problems facing minority communities all over this country, and I'm pledged to do that.
Yeah, and you're not going to brag on it, but my understanding is that back in the early 60s when my dad and I were going door-to-door for Barry Goldwater and Hillary Clinton was a Goldwater girl, you were an organizer for SNCC?
No, I was an organizer. Well, I was involved in the Congress on Racial Equality. Yeah, I mean, this is an issue. You're right.
Of course.
It's not something, it's something that I've been doing for my whole life, my adult life. You know, when I was in college, I got arrested as part of a civil rights demonstration to end segregation in Chicago schools. I went to the University of Chicago. I was involved in making sure that the University of Chicago at that point did not run segregated housing. So, you know, I've been involved in the civil rights movement for many, many years. But the point here is we can give all the great speeches that we want, but what we need is real action to break down racism in America and to create economic opportunity for all of our people, including young African Americans and young Hispanics.
Senator Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be back with Senator Sanders right after the news at the bottom of the hour. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. Your opportunity to call in and ask questions. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good day, Senator Sanders.
Hey, Ed. How are you?
Just fine. I'd like to know if we elect your president, will you pledge to do your best to repeal NAFTA, CAFTA, and the TPP and put Americans back to work in factories like they belong?
Thank you very much for that question, Ed. I think if you have listened to me on the campaign trail or in the halls of the United States Senate and on the floor there, you would know that I helped lead the opposition against NAFTA when I was in the House and against CAFTA, against permanent normal trade relations with China, and I'm currently helping to lead the effort against this disastrous TPP. It is clear to me that all of these trade agreements were written by multinational corporations, Wall Street, the drug companies, with the goal of making it easier for them to shut down in America and move abroad. And that's what they've done. We have lost something like 60,000 factories since 2001, millions of decent paying jobs. So yes, to answer your question, my view is we need a fundamentally new direction in trade. Trade is a good thing, not a bad thing. But trade policies have got to work for the workers of this country and the workers abroad, not just for the CEOs of large corporations who can make huge profits by shutting down here and exploiting poor people in developing countries. So the answer to your question is this is a hugely important issue, something I feel very strongly about. And yes, we will revise significantly our current trade policies.
Morris, listening on KPFK in Los Angeles in Long Beach, California. Morris, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator, Mr. Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst, once suggested that the very first sin of America was racism, implying that it is part of our DNA. As President of the United States, sir, what would you do to help us address this disease? And thank you for taking my call.
Well, I don't think racism is part of our DNA, but I think when we start off with a nation that before, obviously, we became a nation where Africans were brought into this country to be slaves, where the Native Americans were treated beyond shamefully and driven off of their land and in some cases massacred. We do start off, and where immigrants who came to this country, whether they were Irish or Italians or Asians or Jews, whoever they were often treated shamefully. There is a lot of that historical racist baggage that is around our shoulders. On the other hand, what I would tell you, Morris, is we have made some real progress in recent years, but we've got a long, long way to go, as I mentioned earlier. It is no small thing. We take it for granted that we have an African-American president of the United States. 20, 30 years ago, I doubt that very many people thought that that would be possible. But we did overcome that racist heritage in order to elect an African-American. Today, what we are seeing is Republicans trying to divide us up, playing the anti-immigrant card against often against Hispanics. And that is an issue that we have got to address very boldly through comprehensive immigration reform. So I think, and I believe this very sincerely, I'm not the first person to say this, but I do say, as somebody whose dad came to this country at the age of 17 without a nickel in his pocket and became as proud an American as you could possibly know because of the opportunities it gave him and his family, being a nation of diverse people is, in fact, a real strength. And what we have got to overcome is, in fact, as Morris indicates, this centuries of racial tension and racism. I think we are making progress, but obviously we have a long, long way to go. And Tom, I'll tell you something that does concern me very much, is that today, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are hundreds of racist hate groups that are out there now who are trying to foment racial hatred in America. And they are influencing too many young people who have not a whole lot of education. And we need the FBI to take a hard look at these organizations when they are breaking the law. But clearly trying to create a nation and moving toward a nation where we, in fact, fulfill the vision of the Declaration of Independence, that all men, and we believe women, are created equal and entitled to certain unalienable rights. That is our goal. And we've got a lot of work to do it, and I pledge to Morris that I will do everything in my power to try to take on those people who are trying to divide us and bring our nation together.
Alex in Montclair, New Jersey. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Sanders for doing this, and I think it's a great service you're doing. My question really has to do, I mean, speaking of inalienable rights, the Supreme Court case that was recently announced about gay marriage was one of the most gratifying things that I've heard in a very long time, although something that's still concerning is the response from some of the more conservative members of the court. And I wanted to know what your take exactly was on what the legacy of those Supreme Court members would be, if they'd be viewed more as, say, John Marshall or more as Roger Taney.
I think the latter very clearly. And what you're seeing now is a revolution in this country, in many respects, in trying to create a less discriminatory society. And when, you know, we have discussed, and Tom and I talk about every week, the very, very, very serious problems facing our country in terms of income and wealth inequality and high unemployment and poverty and all that, very, very serious problems. On the other hand, we are making good progress in trying to become a society where people are not punished because of their race or their sexual orientation. But clearly we have a long way to go. So I think that those Supreme Court justices who are trying to defend discrimination in terms of gay rights will have a legacy that is not particularly good. And I think those folks who, for 30 or 40 years, this program started with my old friend Ellen Ratner, talking about her struggles for 40 years, advancing gay rights, will be seen, will be looked in the future as real heroes and heroines in the fight for equality in America.
Cassandra in Paulding, Ohio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Mr. Sanders. I live in a rural community and a very conservative libertarian community. One of the problems I see a lot as a young person who is still in high school, I see a lot of my friends and their parents and my own family identifying with these presidential candidates, such as in 2012 Mitt Romney, who is a member of this wealthy 1%. And it breaks my heart because I don't know how to explain to them the best that I can that these people are not acting in the best interests of my community, which I would estimate more than half of us are below the poverty line. I was wondering if you had any idea how someone like me could maybe bring that to light.
Cassandra, thank you very much for asking that excellent question, and thank you as a young person for your perception and your intelligence in thinking things through. what I have said a million times is I don't mind when millionaires and billionaires attack me. It doesn't surprise me because we're beginning to effectively challenge their power, and they don't like that. But what I do dislike very much is when working people vote against their own best interests. So this is what I would say, and I will tell you, Cassandra, that we're going to work as hard as we can just on this issue. So this is what I would tell you. When people in your community who are struggling economically vote for these Republican candidates, have them take a hard look beyond the rhetoric into exactly what these people stand for. And this is what they stand for. And you asked your friends and neighbors in the community, do they really believe that billionaires should get an enormous tax break at the same time as the Republican Party has made huge cuts in Pell Grants, which make it harder for working class kids to get a college education? Do they really think it is a good idea to be supporting trade policies which make it easier for corporate America to shut down in America, move to China and other low-wage countries? Do they really think it is a good idea for candidates who take huge amounts of campaign contributions from corporate interest and billionaires to be opposing efforts to raise the minimum wage to a living wage? Do they really think that's a good idea? Do they think it's a good idea to be supporting candidates who want to cut Medicare and cut Medicaid while at the same time lowering regulations, weakening regulations on Wall Street? I think what we have got to do, Cassandra, is bring forth a very simple and straightforward agenda that makes sense to your community, and at the same time expose the Republicans for what they stand for. And by and large, with very few exceptions, their agenda is the agenda of the billionaire class, and the goal is to make the very, very rich richer at the expense of everybody else. But I think what you got to do is document it, and it's very clear. Many of these Republican candidates for president want to cut Social Security. Well, ask your neighbors if that's a good idea. So I think just get the facts and let your neighbors analyze what these people stand for.
What a refreshing idea, a debate on issues instead of personality and bumper stickers. There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Cliff in Canyon Country, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Professor Tom and Senator Sanders. When I hear this administration talk about climate change, to me it's mostly empty rhetoric, with the president allowing Shell to drill in the Arctic, opening the entire eastern seaboard to drilling, and the way they've sold fracking to the world in China and Eastern Europe and beyond, it contradicts combating climate change. My question is, what's your sense of urgency, and what would you be willing to do to really tackle this extremely important issue of climate change and keeping the fossil fuel in the ground?
But thanks for your question. What I believe, and I've said many, many times, is that climate change is the great planetary crisis that we face, and that we have a moral responsibility to leave this planet for our kids and our grandchildren in a way that is habitable. And if the scientists are right, and I think they are, if we do not move extremely aggressively to transform our energy system, what the scientists are telling us is that by the end of this century, this planet will be between 5 and 10 degrees warmer, which means more drought, more floods, more extreme weather disturbances, more acidification of the ocean, more rising sea levels, more disease, more migrations of people, more international conflict. So I can't think of any issue that is of more significance than this. And I'm proud to tell you that 2 years ago I introduced with Senator Barbara Boxer of California, the most comprehensive climate change legislation, which for the first time imposed a tax on carbon, raised substantial sums of money for energy efficiency and sustainable energies like wind, solar, geothermal, and other sustainable energies. So I consider this, and I, by the way, very, very delighted that the Pope has recently made this into an encyclical and told the world how important this issue is. So count me in as somebody who believes this is a major, major, major issue that we have to take on the fossil fuel industry and transform our energy system.
Senator, we have just a minute to the break. The Pope in his encyclical said that the problem of climate change and the problem of unregulated capitalism are interrelated. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, he's right. I mean, I got to tell you something. You know, we on our website, sanders.senate.gov, we very often post some of the words that Pope Francis has been expressing, because on economics, he is right on. I mean, this guy talks not only about what he calls the dispossessed. That means the children, the young people all over the world who have no jobs, or the elderly people who are sitting lonely without money in their homes making choices between medicine and food. He not only talks about that, but he talks about the idolatry of money. How our culture today, pushed by the billionaire class, says that the only thing that matters is how much money you can acquire. The goal in life is, hey, you too can become a billionaire. And you just don't have to look down the street and worry about kids who are hungry, or about veterans who are sleeping out on the street, or about young people who can't go to college because they come from low-income homes. You don't have to worry about that. Only is all about you and making money. He is so profound on these issues that it is really remarkable.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, sanders.senate.gov, his website. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here. And just a quick programming note, we're for our local affiliates. If you, Sirius is going to be going to the funeral in Charleston as when we get off at the end of this hour. And we're going to be playing a best of show for the second and third hour. If I know some of our affiliates will do local programming about the Supreme Court decision. We were frankly expecting it on Monday, and I've got to hop on a plane to Portland here as soon as we get off. Alex in New Zealand, an American living in New Zealand, watching on sanders.senate.gov or one of Bernie's website, whatever. Alex, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders. As you heard, my name is Alex. I'm a 22-year-old high school graduate with just about a year of community college. I was studying computer science at the University in Oregon, paying for it out of my own pocket because my parents made too much money for me to get government assistance, but not enough to actually help me. And at the end of the day, it ended up just making more sense for me to come on down to this part of the world and contribute to, you know, Oceania's economy. I'm just sort of wondering, if you are elected, you know, what sort of time frame do you expect it might be reasonable to get a system in place that allows me to return to my country and contribute to my country's economy?
Alex, great question, and thank you very much. This is what we have proposed, Alex. What I've said is that it is insane, and I use that word quite advisedly, that we have hundreds of thousands of bright young people in this country who are qualified, who are hardworking, who want to get a higher education, but are unable to do so because of the lack of income in their families. And you just made that case. So we have this, and you're in New Zealand because of that. These people are not only being, these young people are not only being denied the opportunity in many cases to make it to the middle class, but they are unable to contribute their intellectual capabilities to improving life in our country. They're unable to become the scientists, the doctors, the engineers, the teachers, the police officers that we need, because they're not getting the education they require. That's insane. And then you got millions more who are leaving school deeply in debt. $50,000, $100,000. If you're a dentist, it may be $300,000 or $400,000. And they're burdened with this incredible debt at high interest rates for decades. So we have introduced legislation, which I will fight for as President of the United States, that A, makes tuition free at all public colleges and universities in America, and number two, substantially lowers interest rates on student debt. I think that that is not only the right thing to do from the perspective of the individuals impacted, it is absolutely imperative for the future of this country if we are to have the best educated workforce in the world and create the economy that we need in the future.
Victoria in Caldwell, Idaho. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yes, thank you, Senator, for recognizing we must target investment in education. The Every Child Achieves Act continues the privatization mechanisms of No Child Left Behind. In light of that, when S-1177 comes to the floor on July 7th for your vote, will you now be voting no?
I apologize. I do not know what 1177 is.
That's the Every Child Achieves Act?
Oh, I see. Well, needless to say, I am 100% against educational privatization, of which the right wing in this country is pushing very hard. They want to privatize everything under the sun, including our military and our public services and Social Security and public education as well. So it goes without saying that I am strongly opposed to that. But what I will also tell you, Victoria, is that we're going to do everything that we can to end No Child Left Behind. And the burden that many teachers and students are under today, where schools are teaching kids to take tests rather than giving them the quality education that they need. And I'm on the committee that deals with that, so we're hopefully going to end this No Child Left Behind and come up with a system that works much better for the kids and the teachers.
Ed, in Belfair, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, my question has to do with Fast Track. And now that the president has that authority to sign a trade bill, when a trade bill comes to his desk, does he have the option with the stroke of a pen to delete or take anything out of a trade bill, or does he have to send it back to the perpetrators that authored the trade bill for changes to be made so he can give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down? But is he allowed to make any changes in any of the trade bills that come before his desk?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, the answer is no. Essentially, what this fast track authority was about is to say, okay, you have an agreement right now, which is essentially completed. What you now have is the authority to get an agreement with 11 other countries. And then once that agreement is agreed upon by all 12 countries, it will come back to the Congress, and there will not be any amendments allowed. There will not be any, it'll be a 50-vote situation in the House, not a 60-vote, and the president cannot change it because then it would have to go back to the 11 other countries and the whole process would continue. So to answer your question, to the best of my knowledge, the answer is no. Once the president concludes negotiations and has an agreement, it comes to the Senate, comes to the House, up and down vote, no amendments, and he signs it.
Senator, we have just a minute left. Final thoughts for the day?
Well, you know, I want to get back to the point that young lady, I think her name was Cassandra, raised a little while ago, and talking about how she communicates with people in her own communities who continue to vote against their own best interests. Now, sometimes I have to say it is very hard to get information about what the Republican Party really stands for through the media. They're not particularly, for whatever variety of reasons, not particularly happy about discussing it. But I hope that everybody understands that a month, 6 weeks ago, the Republicans passed a budget which says the following. They repeal completely the Affordable Care Act, make massive cuts in Medicaid. The result is that 27 million Americans are thrown off of health insurance. What the Republican budget did was cut Pell Grants by $90 billion over a 10-year period, making it harder for working-class families to be able to send their kids to college. What the Republican budget did, massive cuts in nutrition programs, increasing hunger in America, and then, on top of all that, they give huge tax breaks to billionaires. This is not an agenda that the American people support. We've got to get the word out for what these guys are standing for.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much today and every time, every day. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the Pope has come out and said, you know, you can't be a Christian and be a gun manufacturer or investor. It's very interesting. In the United States, one in three people know someone who's been shot. On average, 31 Americans are murdered with guns every day. 151 are treated for a gun assault in an emergency room every day. On average, every day in the United States, 55 people kill themselves with a firearm. 46 are shot or killed by accident. More than half of them children. The U.S. firearm homicide rate is 20 times higher than the combined rates of 22 countries that equal our wealth and population. 20 times higher. A gun in a home makes it 22 times more likely that it will be used to kill or injure in a domestic homicide, suicide, or unintentional shooting. 2,200% more likely than that it will be used in self-defense. An average of 7 children and teens under the age of 20 are killed by guns every day. American children die by guns 11 times. That's 1,100% more frequently than children in other high-income countries. I could go on and on, but and then we get this, follow the money with the NRA. As an NRA leader, this by Sarah Jones over at Politicus USA. After an NRA leader predictably blamed the Charleston victims for their own death, tone deaf, ignorant, whatever. The NRA is a virtual subsidiary of the gun industry, according to Business Insider. Business Insider said since 2005, the gun industry and its corporate allies have given between $20 and $52 million to the NRA through their Ring of Freedom sponsor program. Donors include firearm companies like Midway USA, Springfield Armory, Inc., Pierce Bullet Seal Target Systems, and Beretta USA Corporations. Other supporters of the gun industry include Cablas, Storm Ruger & Company, and Smith & Wesson. The NRA also made $20.9 million, about 10% of its revenue, from selling advertising to industry companies marketing products in its many publications in 2010, according to IRS Form 990. Additionally, some companies donate portions of their sales directly to the NRA. Crimson Trace, which makes laser sights, donates 10%. Taurus gives an NRA membership to everyone who buys one of their guns. Storm Ruger gives $1 to the NRA for every gun sold, which amounts to millions. The NRA's revenues are intrinsically linked to the success of the gun business. End of quote from Business Insider. And now the Pope comes along and says, you can't be a Christian if you're involved in this business. So, Neil McCabe, political director of Gravis Insights, Florida-based pollster and columnist at townhall.com, gravisinsights.com, the website. Neil, is Wayne LaPierre going to burn in hell? It sure looks like it to me. He's Catholic. The Pope just basically disowned him.
I'm really troubled and kind of hurt because I don't believe the Holy Father fully comprehends the weight of his words in the United States. And it can't be.
I think he's fully aware of it. And God bless him. How can you be a Christian and manufacture weapons of death? Would Jesus do that? Would he encourage his disciples to do that?
Well, you know.
Serious question.
Pope John Paul II.
No, serious question. Would
said that there was a right to self-defense, to defend yourself and to defend people that you love. And he said, he said that you have that right to make that decision.
Well, of course, everybody has a right to self-defense. Does that mean that everybody has the right to manufacture, to sell, to promote weapons of mass destruction and weapons of death?
Well, I mean, it's death to you and it's safety to me. I mean, it's like, is my sword, so my sword is okay? So if I run around with a big axe like one of the Swiss guards, I'm okay? I mean, I knew pretty well one of the Swiss guards who for many years was a bodyguard for Pope John Paul I. He's surrounded by three plainclothesmen who are members of the Swiss guards who are unarmed, and their only job is to take a bullet for the Holy Father.
Right.
However, everywhere he goes, he's surrounded by 20 machine guns.
Yeah, he's the Pope.
And so does he wonder where these machine guns came from? Were they found in a wine jar in the temple? Did they descend from the clouds? I mean, somebody had to make these guns that are protecting the Holy Father.
Somebody who he doesn't consider a good Christian. You got a problem with that?
It seems like it hasn't been.
I mean, he drives around a Pope mobile. It's powered by fossil fuels, and he's condemning the fossil fuel industry too. You know, there are times when you have to compromise, but that doesn't. You know, you haven't answered my question. You know, what would Jesus say to his disciples? Should they go into the gun industry or not? And should they shill for the gun industry the way that the NRA does?
I think that
number one. And number two, you haven't answered my question. Do you think Wayne LaPierre is going to burn in hell for what he has done, which has promoted so many deaths in this country?
Oh, listen, Wayne LaPierre is not going to hell, if only for the suffering that has been inflicted upon him by the left.
You mean the millions of dollars a year in income he's taking?
I'm talking about the emotional damage he's had.
My heart is breaking, Neil. My heart is breaking.
Listen, he's not going to listen. We're not going to condemn
this
him.
This guy is a liar and a fraud.
All right, let's talk about our Savior. Our Savior told us to love one another, and our Savior certainly understood that we have an obligation to protect those who can't protect themselves. And so I would,
but not by weapons. Look at what Jesus did and said when Peter pulled his sword just before they took him off to crucify him and cut off the ear of one of the Roman centurions. What did Jesus say?
He who lives by the sword dies by the sword.
And put away your weapon.
And he healed away that. But at the same time, there was another agenda going on. There was another cosmic strip that Peter was interfering with. I believe it was necessary for our Lord not to be rescued, but actually our Lord needed to go to that cross. So Peter was sort of interfering with the prime directive there.
I don't disagree, but still Jesus used it as a teaching moment, assuming that all those things are accurate.
A teaching moment, but I don't think that our Lord would have a problem with a father defending his family from intruders.
I don't either.
Unless your reading of the scripture says
that I am not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that the Pope is right, that you can't be a good Christian and be promoting profiting from guns.
It's very disturbing. It's very, very disturbing. And I haven't had the opportunity to go to some people that I trust to talk about how that was translated into English. In the past, some of the things that the Holy Father has said has been given a very generous translation to play up to one faction or another. But in the main, I am very troubled that the Pope is sort of wandering into this.
You know, another 3-year-old yesterday found a gun in his under the couch that his father had, a loaded gun, and killed his friend. Actually, this was a 5-year-old. And I mean, this happens a half a dozen times a day in the United States. And the people who are promoting these weapons, which are 22 times more likely to end, if they're in a home, it's 22 times more likely to end up the way I just described than somebody trying to defend themselves.
Tom,
they're complicit in those deaths.
Unfortunately, tragedy with the 3-year-old.
This was not unfortunate.
Horrible,
it was predictable.
But it is unfortunate. It was also
predictable. 2,200% probability.
These tragedies also, in the end, save thousands of other lives as people refocus on safety and they realize the tragedy and they learn from it.
So we kill 100,000 people, we save 1,000, and the gun industry makes a profit, and that's a good thing?
It's like what happens when you find out they didn't wear their seatbelt and they were killed in an accident. You're more likely to wear your seatbelt after.
Seatbelts don't kill people, man.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil McCabe, sorry to dump the last
one
on you there.
No, I understand.
GravisInsights.com. Neil McCabe, thanks for dropping by, Neil. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse, how you doing?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, Tom, Jill Stein, the Green Party.
Yeah.
She's running for president again.
Good.
And she support nationalizing the Federal Reserve and public banking.
Yep.
Well, We talk about that, but do you think people really understand what it really means if we could control our money?
I doubt most Americans have any idea what it means, Jesse. I think that you are exceptionally well-educated in this topic, and you're the exception rather than the rule for all Americans.
Well, I don't think so. I think everybody can understand it, basically. What it would mean if we could cut a 30-year mortgage to basically 10 years if we control the money, would we want to charge ourselves the front end of 20 years of interest?
Right.
I don't think so.
Well, so this is one of the things that concerns me about this fast track thing, is that the fast track bill will allow Congress to push through this TPIS agreement. It's not, and it may be part of the TPP too, but we know that it's part of TPIS because it's been leaked, which will make it illegal for individual states in the United States to run state-owned banks like North Dakota does. No more public banking. Everything has to be done for a buck by professional privateers, by banksters.
Well, and, Tom, you know where there's a will, there's a way. I asked you many years ago, would you want to start a public bank? You said, no, I'm no good at money. Louise handled the money.
Yeah.
Well, I make you think back to when the aristocrats used to think people was too stupid to run the democracy. Would you want to give up your vote in a public bank or Federal Reserve to Wall Street versus your knowledge of economics? I don't think so.
No.
So
no, but this is why I'm a big advocate of credit unions as well, because they're democratic institutions.
Right. Well, what the basic principle is, the people run the show.
Right.
And if we're going to have Greece, us get out of the jam we are, whereas we owe, well, we're fractionalizing, I'm saying that word wrong, the earth instead of fractionalizing money, and we know we only got one earth, so we know capitalism don't work.
Right.
So if we're going to use money printed by us and base it off Mother Earth, that's the way we got to go. There's no argument about it.
You're talking about the gold standard?
Yeah, because that's irrelevant. You know, yeah. Money is a state of mind. We can't think that way no more.
Money is something that in theory reflects human labor. I mean, that was the whole point, that money would be a medium of exchange.
One earth. If we're going to try to dream up what gold, what we want it to be worth, diamonds, oil, you name it, we're not living in reality.
Yeah. Jesse, science fiction writer Jack Vance, one of my favorite science fiction writers, wrote a whole series of novels that take place on other planets and galaxies and whatnot. But in all of them, all across the Gaian Reach, the money that everybody uses is called the SVU, single value unit. And it represents, one SVU represents 1 hour of labor by one human being anywhere. So the value of labor was equalized across the universe, and the value of money was based on the value of labor. That, to me, actually seems, instead of basing the value of money on gold, that to me actually seems like a much more commonsensical thing to do. And just say, okay, $1 equals 1 hour of labor, and let's let everything else conform itself to that. Jesse, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back as I'm chugging down my beet juice. Good stuff. Okay. What could I say? Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today? Alan? It's line 9. Yeah. Okay. Albert in Los Angeles. Hey, Albert, can you hear me? Albert can't hear me either. Okay, let's try John in Minneapolis. John, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
And you're on line 10. This is weird. Anyway, back to you, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think perhaps corporate America or the powers that be find racist, hateful people useful, because I think the things that they do, and they relate to it, because I think that the things that they do are rather hateful and not very nice either. And so you have this army of people that you can, you know, use your goons in case things get rough and people get too lippy and the Occupy movement gets too big. You can, unleash the hounds on the rest of us.
Right.
Right.
And then also, you know, I wanted to say about this shooter, you know, James Gilligan wrote a book. He was a psychiatrist, and he wrote a book on called Violence in America, I think it was called. And one of the things that he said, which I think is kind of interesting, you know, this shooter expressed the idea that he had to do this. And I think that he had to do it to kind of build up his lack of self-esteem. You know, he was a kind of a loner, somewhat of a loser. And I think that joining a racist group often, you know, people can build up their ego, not in a healthy way.
No, John, you are so right about that. And let me add to that. I think it's the same thing with the guns. You know, we created this thing called the Small Penis Gun Club. And I think the men who are insecure about their sexuality are the ones who are most obsessed with guns. And I think that men who are insecure about their ability to be providers for their family, and, you know, which is increasing across the United States as Reaganomics destroys the middle class, they're the ones who are most likely to become pretty fanatic about racism.
Yeah, and I think they do this, it's to save face, and they were willing to die, you know, for it too, because, you know, they feel like they have nothing to live for, that they've been so, their egos are so destroyed,
yeah,
because we do live in a very competitive society. And, these people are kind of marginalized, I think, often and left out, you know, this is what they turn to, which is violence.
Yeah. Yep. I'm with you. John, thank you for the call. Well said. Albert in Los Angeles. Hey, Albert, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call. Can you
sure.
hear me?
Just fine, yeah.
Oh, okay, perfect. I'd just like to have a quick conversation about, you know, diversity. You know, I'm a black male, young 30s. Coming up in the 90s, the biggest thing that, you know, the biggest buzzword we heard was diversity, multiculturalism, and things of that nature.
Right.
And that's kind of gone away. And, you know, social media is just pounding, you know, with racist this, racist that. And, you know, I'm getting backlash from some of my white friends who are saying, hey, you know, you're always talking about race as of late. And I brought up one quick example to them. I said, okay, Google Adam and Eve. And then I went through the whole scientific reason. You know, the only reason why there's difference in skin tone is really basically genes, X's and Y chromosomes, and people can have different skin tones. So we're really all the same race. But my point is, why was every single picture that they Googled of a white person? And right. I think we need to have a
and Adam and Eve
about.
If we wanted to literally say Adam and Eve were the first humans, then they were Tanzanians or Kenyans.
Exactly, and they had to have been of dark skin, because
right.
you just genetically you can't having light skin is just a recessive.
Well, it was the climate. I mean, the difference between you and me is the melanin in our skin. That's it. And, you know, your skin is more accommodating to intense sunlight, and mine is more accommodating to long winters with very little sunlight. I make vitamin D more easily than you do, and you get skin cancer less easily than I do. It has to do with a single chemical in our skin, and that's the only difference.
Right, that's the only difference. And my point was, why does every single picture have to be of a white person, knowing that the chances of that is not true? And that's not to demean anybody. It's just because we feel comfortable looking at images of ourselves.
Do you mean that as a literal question or a rhetorical question? Because, you know, I mean, if you mean it literally, I'd say it's because, you know, the power structure in America is white. The textbooks are written by white people. The TV networks are all run by white people.
Exactly. So that's my point. And back to this white privilege, I don't think we should be using white privilege, because certain white people can't understand that it's not necessarily privilege. We live in a democracy, which is majority rules. And just what you just said, I don't want to say it's not a privilege. You know, white people receive benefits because they're the majority race
right.
in the country.
But Albert, your white friends who say to you, why are you talking about race all the time? Have you ever tried saying to them, hey, that's the number one benefit of white privilege, is that you don't have to wonder how your race is going to impact the quality of your day?
I tried, but the way to solve it is to just have more different people.
More diversity.
And things that we see.
Yeah, I'm with you. Albert, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back after the news at the bottom of the hour. It's Anything Goes Summer, and, boy, the Senate. Tomorrow, the final vote on Fast Track. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Sons of Confederate Veterans are mobilizing. A big mass email just went out to all our members. There's apparently 20-some-odd thousand members of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. To become a member, you have to prove that first of all, you have to be a man. And I'm assuming that there's probably also a daughters of American veterans, or of the Confederate veterans, excuse me. And you have to prove that you have an ancestor who fought in the Civil War on the side of the Confederacy. And they're very upset about Nikki Haley pushing the legislature in South Carolina to take down Robert E. Lee's flag. And I find it very, very strange. I'm a member of Sons of the American Revolution. Just happened this year, actually. My mom, when I was a kid, started getting into genealogy, and because her family had been in North America since the 1600s, mostly up in Massachusetts. And she had traced back our genealogy to and before the Revolutionary War, and pretty much all in the North, no slaveholders, thank God. And so, you know, her request to me before she died, one of her requests to me, this was actually a couple of years before she died, but when she knew that she could no longer do this genealogy work, was to please finish it so that her grandchildren could qualify for DAR, which is what she wanted to be, Daughters of the American Revolution, and SAR, Sons of the American Revolution, because there's some scholarships and stuff associated with that, and she just thought it was cool that, you know, whatever. And so I hired a genealogist two years ago, and it took about a year to track it all down. And sure enough, there it was, and we submitted the application. And now my kids qualify for this, and I have committed, I've fulfilled my commitment to my mother. But the net of all this is that I have some understanding of this process. My father wouldn't have qualified because his parents came here from Norway, but on my mother's side, you know, it goes all the way back to the 1600s. And one of the things that is just astonishing to me is that, you know, the Sons of the American Revolution, the group that I'm a member of, I mean, they're just basically all about being patriotic Americans. So far, my sense of it is there's not Democrats or Republicans. You know, when I met with these guys, you know, somebody said, "What do you do?" And I said, "You know, I'm the left wing Rush Limbaugh. I do a progressive radio show," and a couple people were like, "Hey, cool." And other people were like, "Well, that should be interesting." You know, I mean, you can tell people's politics, but, you know, nobody was, you know, it's not a political organization. But apparently the Sons of Confederate Veterans are a little more aggressive, shall we say. Interesting story over at Talking Points Memo at TPM. Anyhow, Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Yes, I'm surprised that some of the black people in Charleston are so inclusive.
You're talking about like the church service Sunday, they welcomed all the white folks into the church?
Yes, of course. Yes, yeah, of course. If I or my children were told for a couple of centuries that their brains weren't as large as Europeans, or that they are genetically limited, you know, by authors such as Charles Murray and the Bell Curve,
right,
I would be absolutely furious. I think if people receive these kinds of indignities, they can only be like extremely frustrated and angry. I actually applaud them for their spirit. I think the human spirit is amazing, whether it be Jewish people in Germany or other ethnic groups that have gone through incredible discrimination and tragedy.
Yeah. This happens all around the world. It's the Karen people in Thailand right now being persecuted, for example.
Yeah. I mean, this stuff continues. And I remember a quote that, you know, I love Jefferson, by a quote, I remember reading him a quote by him that he said, the slaves on his plantation worked, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours a day, whatever it was. And he said, I don't really understand these people, because at the end of the day, they are, they're still very spirited, and, you know, they may sing songs or do whatever. I'm sure it was a survival mechanism for them. But it actually is, their story is an incredible story, along with many other groups of the human spirit.
Yeah, and you can go out to Monticello now, and you can see where the concentration camp was.
Yeah.
Basically.
I visited there a long
called
time ago.
The slave quarters.
This is new. They've had it in the past 10 years. They've built that, or?
Yeah. Yeah, we were there last year, the year before, and it was evident that it was new. I mean, all the signs and everything that had to do with the slave quarters looked much more modern than some of the older signage.
Oh, okay. Okay, it's very interesting, yeah.
So I'm very impressed too by the folks at Mother Emanuel Church and across Charleston, that there has not been an explosion of anger, thank God. Obviously a lot of grief, but a call for healing, and I hope that this is a moment in America that could be an extraordinary teaching moment, or could just slide into the memory hole. And only time will tell. A lot will, however, have to do with whether or not we continue discussing all of these various things and what we do about it. And what we do about it means at law. And after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, which had passed the Senate by a 99-0 vote, you know, passed the Senate unanimously, one person didn't vote. I think one person was I think it might have been, you know, dead or something, but whatever. But John Roberts still said, well, you know, we no longer have, you know, legal segregation in the United States. And like the president pointed out in Mark Maron's podcast a couple days ago, you know, it's you don't use the N-word in polite company. And therefore, racism is dead. Well, I'm sorry. Racism is alive and well. It just has taken a more subtle, you know, as Joe Madison says, it's no longer Jim Crow, it's James Crow ESQ. And I would say that this newer, subtler, deeper form of racism is in some ways even more dangerous to the American body politic than the good old boy, obvious kind of, you know, dumb racism. I'm looking for words that I can say on the radio. I'm lacking them. Anyhow, Alan, thank you for the call. I agree with you. Mac in Cowdery, Colorado. Hey, Mac, what's up?
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
First off, I have to tell you that your show matters.
Thank you.
It has had an unmeasurable positive impact on my psyche.
Thank you. So what's on your mind?
Well, about 10 years ago, I got the courage to visit the wall in Washington, D.C.
You mean the Vietnam Veterans, the Vietnam Memorial?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I knew way too many names on it.
Yeah. I walked by that a few months ago, and I couldn't even look for the names that I knew. I was afraid to do it. I just didn't think I could handle it. I'm sorry, Mac. Back to you.
Well, I had the same reaction, but I had to go.
Yeah.
And once I got over the grief and the anger, I looked back at that wall, and it hit me with such clarity. Political rhetoric has consequences.
Yeah, led to that wall.
Rhetoric, it has life and death consequences. And I found a parallel between that wall and those political rhetoric and the political rhetoric that this young man in Charleston heard from all the Republican leaders ever since President Obama has been elected.
Yeah.
I've heard Republican after Republican stand up and say he's ruining the world. He's driving this country in the ground. It's going in the wrong way. He's taking over.
He's not one of us.
Surprised.
He's not a real American. Where's his birth certificate? These are all code for, hey, have you noticed the guy in the White House is black?
Well, yes, I was not surprised. The only thing that surprised me about the Charleston thing is that actually that it wasn't the direct attack against the president.
Yeah. Well, he assassinated a state senator. And he did it in a church that had been started by Vesey, what was his last name? The guy who led the slave rebellion, and I think it was in 1822. And then they hanged him along with a bunch of other folks, and or he didn't lead it. He conspired to lead it. And then they banned black churches until after the Civil War, and they burned that church down. It got rebuilt after the Civil War. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of history in Mother Emanuel Church, and this was an assault on that history as well as on the people in that church.
Yes, and that is so telling of how society actually is.
Yeah.
People don't say the N-word in public anymore. It is so prevalent.
Yeah, but all they have to say is, well, you know, Obama's probably not a real U.S. citizen, or he's not a particularly good president, and, you know, whatever. I mean, it's like Lee Atwater said, you know, we don't have to use the N-word anymore. All we have to do is talk about tax cuts, and everybody gets it that, you know, we're talking about helping out rich people and screwing the poor people, especially the people of color.
Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls, and Bob Ney is going to drop by with the Talk Radio News Service in about 5 minutes. Stick around. Well, welcome back. Fred, watching Free Speech TV in Atlanta on the Dish Network. Hey, Fred, what's up? Fred, can you hear me? Fred is on line two, and he can't hear me. Or maybe he just has his phone muted. Bo in Detroit, Michigan. Bo, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. How are you doing, Tom?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good. I really enjoy your show. Well, I always have.
Thank you.
Yeah. Listen, first I want to say I actually went to Michigan State, I think, at the same time you did.
I'm sorry. Your voice is kind of muffled, Bo. Could you say that again?
I said I went to Michigan State at the same time you did.
Oh, really? You were at MSU in the 60s, the late 60s?
Well, yeah, well, I actually started in 1970.
Uh-huh. Okay. I was there. I had a summer scholarship when I was 14. That would have been 63, and then I attended for less than one term in 68. So, for what it's worth.
Okay. I thought you were there at the same time.
No.
The exact same time I was.
I think I'm a little older than you are.
You lived in Snyder Phillips.
Yeah, Phillips Hall.
Yeah, Snyder Phillips.
Snyder Phillips, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, what I wanted to say is that, I'm not quite as forgiving as some of my people are about the incidents that have occurred in Charleston and some of the other incidents that have been involved with. In fact, I've been involved with the Black Liberation Movement for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know, are you familiar with the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, who passed last year?
No, I don't know him. I don't know that much about him.
Okay, his name was Chukwuma Lumumba. Anyway, he was billed as America's most revolutionary mayor. He was on Democracy Now! And a couple other programs.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, anyway. But anyway, I'm just not quite as forgiving. I don't consider myself an American. I consider myself a new African. You know, and to me, American is somebody, if I have native Aboriginal people in my family, calling myself an American to me is an insult to them.
Yeah.
Because that means that they get...
Do you, Bo, are you talking kind of in Malcolm X terms? You know, it's time for black people to basically circle the wagon and create their own institutions? Your own institution?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually belong to Malcolm X grassroots movement. Are you familiar with them?
I'm sorry. Your phone is really muffled, Bo. If you could make sure that you don't have a thumb over the microphone or anything. Say that again.
I said, are you familiar with Malcolm X grassroots movement?
Yes.
Okay. I am the regional director in Detroit.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And the guy who I was telling you about, who was the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, actually was the chairman of the national organization.
Okay.
You know, so yeah, I do think we need to circle the wagons. I think that there's enough. Are you familiar? Would you ever consider having Dr. Francis Kress Welsing on your show?
I'll consider having anybody on the show. Bo, pitch it to Sean Taylor. She's our executive director. Her contact information, I'm pretty sure, is on our website.
Because he talked about these small penis gun owners.
Yeah.
He deals almost directly psychologically with that whole idea.
Yeah. Interesting. Bo, thanks a lot for the call. I gotta run here, but thank you for the call. And go Spartans. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, the book that tells how Washington really works, is on the line with us. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today, sir?
Well, we're going to see more of how Washington works once this entire trade bill saga cleans out. But we are awaiting two rulings from the Supreme Court, of course. We don't know what day they'll come, one being the marriage equality, and the other, of course, will be the health care bill.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, we do know the vote of 60-37 on the trade bill, which was a razor-thin, right-on-the-nose vote for procedural motion. Then the trade bill itself will, of course, pass, because it'll need a simple majority now.
You think so? Because I got an email from Lori Wallach this morning. I mean, it was a mass email. It wasn't just personalized to me. I mean, but Public Citizen, you know, and their trade division, that said basically when the American people see what is in TPP, because there will be a 60-day period where we actually get to see what's in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that there's going to be so much revulsion and disgust that even though they don't need, even though, it, you know, it can't be filibuster, they don't need 60 votes in the Senate, they only need 50 votes in the Senate, that there's still a very good chance that we can fight this thing the way that we fought SOPA and PIPA and you know, fought for net neutrality. And there's been a number of really surprising and substantial grassroots victories recently.
Oh, I'm not saying by any stretch of imagination that anybody should, you know, lay down on this, but I think the bill is horrible, Tom, personally.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think it's terrible. But right now, Mitch McConnell, I believe, alone with the Republicans, has the votes. It's going to, I agree, though, with her, there are going to be things that are going to be absolutely revolting. And if you look at the polling on this, and if you look at the phone calls, now, I was told by a couple of staffers it was amazing. And, you know, they would think normally a congressman would react to that and vote against this. So I still think there's always hope for anything. But Mitch McConnell has maneuvered this thing. I mean, he wanted it with a passion. So did John Boehner. And I think I'm safe in saying you're going to see a money trail to this when it comes to John Boehner and Mitch McConnell. I think the president was in it for a different ball game, different reason, although, you know, I wouldn't be happy, you know, with why he's supporting this. But I think that they'll continue on to do anything humanly possible. But again, I think she's correct. And, you know, nobody should lay down on this that's against it. But it's just amazing that it made it razor thin right on the nose.
Yeah. I don't find it quite so amazing, because there's literally trillions of dollars at stake here, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits, and it's fairly cheap to buy members of Congress. I mean, $100,000, $200,000, you know, that's big money in Washington, D.C., even still these days. And, you know, if you've got a couple of billion dollars on the line, buying a couple of hundred members of Congress doesn't seem like a big, sure, big lift, frankly.
When I say amazing, in the past, these trade bills had wider margins, but this one, I think, people finally have woken up so much around the country, and even on the Republican citizen side,
Yeah.
The average citizen is just absolutely appalled by this piece of legislation.
Well, and they've got Drudge and they've got Mark Levin. I mean, there's a couple of right-wing sites, and the Obamatrade.com website that Curtis Ellis put together is brilliant. And they're all from a totally right-wing perspective.
Right. And, of course, Ted Cruz is against it now because he just can't stand anything that President Obama wants, which, you know, Cruz is finished. I hate to even mention his name in the process. I did want to mention the flag debate. Tom, have you carried any of the story about Earl Holt by chance?
No. I don't know who Earl Holt is.
The site, and I've got to look down at my notes here, but the site would be crooksandliars.com.
Oh, is Earl Holt the Conservative Citizens Council guy who was given money, $57,000, as I recall, to the various Republican candidates?
That's it. And you've got Mitt Romney, Rob Portman of Ohio, Ron Johnson, Sharon Angle, Ken Buck. I mean, it goes on and on. You've got also Rick Santorum. And the reason I mention this story is because now – not only in the Carolinas has the flag debate taken a complete different turn, but now Mississippi, the Speaker of the House, who's now had an enlightenment that it's time to remove the flag. And I mention this because with this man's money, Earl Holt, and if you would see his quotes, which I really wouldn't want to read on your show, but if you go to crooksandliars.com, his quotes are just horrible, and not only about African Americans, but about Jewish people. But he has passed out money and around. So I think on the Republican side, you know, how they say there's going to be some explaining to do. I think on their side, how they ever got wrapped up with the guy. People turn bad. I understand it. But
this is the Southern strategy, Bob. Nixon came up with this idea that, you know, the Strom Thurmond had gone off and started the Dixiecrats back in the late 50s, you know, in response to Brown v. Board, and they were Democratic white racists. And Richard Nixon said, if I'm going to win, I need to get those Democratic white racists. And he created the Southern strategy. And then Reagan put it on steroids after his first speech after the Republican nominating convention. His first speech as an official candidate for president of the United States was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is the town where Cheney and Schwerner and Goodman were murdered, the three civil rights actors, activists, excuse me. And he gave a speech on states' rights. I mean, you know, racism has been like the in the South in particular, has been like one of the major ways that the Republican Party has been able to win victories.
Well, this spread across, and you've even got, you know, like I said, Rick Santorum, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul.
Yeah.
And I mention this because it's becoming the, you know, celebrity cause of the day on the flag. And I'm not trying to say we're reporting that's a bad thing. But you look at the amount of money that came from this man of, you know, $65,000+, and the fact that people were brazen enough to take it. I think there are people going to be doing a lot of reverse positions very, very fast.
Yeah. The question is, will they stop the talking in code stuff? You know, is Obama really a citizen, et cetera, all this other stuff. Bob Nay, author of Sideswipe for the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I'm very pleased and honored to have Sam Daly Harris, founder of Results, the CEO of the Center for Citizen Empowerment and Transformation, the author of an extraordinary book, Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Government, with a foreword by Nobel Peace Prize laureate Muhammad Yunus, and a new chapter on the Citizens Climate Lobby. Great stuff, Sam.
Great, thanks.
It's great
thanks.
Having you with us, as always. The revolution is underway. Let's talk about citizen activism. You work with a lot of groups.
Well, let me just say the messages from the book are, number one, most people are cynical and hopeless about making a difference with their voices as citizens, sad to say. Number two, over the last 35 years, I've seen people make a profound difference. Mm-hmm. Number three, which is the tough one, you got to find an organization that offers you more than mouse clicks. You've got to find an organization that offers a structure of support whereby you're in groups and you have maybe a monthly conference call, guest speakers, and you get to go from kindergarten, third, fifth, ninth, 12th grade and beyond as an activist.
You know, and there's such a broad spectrum of them. I mean, at the kind of base of the pyramid, as it were, there's things like drinking liberally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's chapters all over the country. Where people just get together, you know, at a bar, and then they got screening liberally in New York and some of the larger cities where they get together. And then you go to things like Democratic Underground, the Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, or MoveToAmend.org, which now has 500 chapters around the country.
Right.
People starting literally starting chapters in their kitchens, you know, just say, okay, I can do this. Tell us about some of the groups that you know.
Yeah, so for example, I'm in town this particular week because Citizens Climate Lobby is having their annual conference.
Mm-hmm.
6 years ago, they had 25 people here. Today, they've got 800 here.
Wow.
And the difference is they're not just on the Hill today and they go home and they'll be back in a year. No, they go home and they'll be back in their congressman's office in August or October or February or April or whatever.
The local offices.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's not a one-and-done kind of thing. It's an ongoing kind of growth. Last year, their volunteers in the U.S. and Canada had 2,253 letters to the editor published, up from 36 in 2010. Something's going on there, and the something is grassroots empowerment. And so you need to link with a group like them, citizensclimatelobby.org or results.org on global and domestic poverty or peacealliance.org on peace issues if you want more than the mouse clicks.
Yeah. One of the things that I was noticing and talking about back in 2010 when the Tea Party started, well, really 2009 when the Tea Party started emerging, initially I think as a backlash to the first black president being elected, and largely, and then secondarily a backlash to a Democrat being elected. Oh my God! Mm-hmm. And then we watched the Tea Party basically be taken over by shills for the Koch brothers. You know, where $300,000 brand new spiffy fancy painted buses were bringing Tea Partiers into Washington D.C. to quote hold rallies and things, and it's kind of degenerated and fallen apart since then. But there was this strain that ran through it, setting aside the racist strain and setting aside the corporatist shills and manipulators. There were a lot of people of good heart and good faith, maybe misguided. They've been watching Fox News too long, who showed up because our government is not working. You know, it's been ever since the Powell memo. Lewis Powell was successful. He started that in '76 when he wrote the Buckley case, and basically the corporations have taken over to a large extent. And it looked to me like this is populism, and I'm seeing it on the right, and I'm seeing this incredible populist movement. And I started wondering, you know, where's the populist movement on the left? Where is it? You know, when's it going to happen? Because I was part of one in the '60s. I was in SDS, and it was very much it was a student movement, but it was also a populist movement. It was a grassroots movement. And now I'm seeing that happening around Bernie Sanders. I'm seeing that happen around a lot of these groups that you're talking about. It seems to me that we're at one of those moments in the history of our country. And I think they happen at probably every other generation or maybe every third generation where there's actually a craving, a longing for, I want to participate, I want to be part of something, I want to do something more than just vote, more than just complain.
I saw your interview with Hedrick Smith a couple of weeks ago where he talks about, don't look here in Washington for the change. Look at what's going on out in communities.
Yeah.
On Move to Amend, on the hourly wage, et cetera, et cetera. So, but when people do get together and they do connect with others, there's got to be some there for them to, like, grow. I was speaking last year at an elite university in the United States, and I had the honor of meeting a professor of organizing, genius guy, and I talked for 20 minutes about the work, and he said, why do you do it that way, and how does this work? And then he looks at me and says, yeah, but Congress is really dysfunctional. I said, yeah, Congress is really dysfunctional, and last year it appropriated $1.65 billion for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Congress is really dysfunctional. Last year appropriated $715 million from maternal and child health programs around the world. Congress is really dysfunctional, but if you roll up your sleeves, do your homework, and get in there, you can make some big things happen. So people need to know that even people of stature see the whole thing as a mess and dysfunctional, and yet we need to engage but get some support if we do.
So rules for the road. You want to start a group, you're joining a group, you want to have the maximum impact with your life.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, the bottom line is you might be group shopping.
Uh-huh.
And the shopping is, where's a group that feeds me?
Right.
You know, that I go there and I walk in 1 foot tall and I kind of walk out after a few months, 3 feet, 5 feet tall kind of thing. They're really feeding me with information, and more than information, with empowerment. I mean, a group like the Peace Alliance would be working on the Youth Promise Act, funding violence prevention programs around the U.S. They'll have a monthly conference call. Maybe Bobby Scott, the congressman from North Carolina, who introduced it, is a guest kind of thing.
Right.
And Results might be working on global poverty, and they'll have Paul Farmer from Partners in Health as a guest speaker one of the months. So you're kind of in this like ongoing education piece that takes you to another level.
Bernie Sanders once suggested, actually many times on this program, he's been on every Friday for 10 years now, that what you should do is find a hall, like, you know, rent the school gymnasium or whatever you can get, you know, find a hall that you can get cheap or for free. Rent it or, you know, book it, and then go to your member of the House of Representatives and say, we're going to have a town hall. We're putting up posters all over the town, and we're advertising that you're going to be there.
Okay, that's one way to go.
And then out of that, the people who put that thing together become the local activist group. Yeah. You know, I mean, this is like, there's so many ways to start this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I just need to get going. And there's this quote from Apollo astronaut Rusty Schweikert who said, we aren't passengers on spaceship Earth. We're the crew.
Yeah.
We aren't residents on this planet. We're citizens.
Right.
The difference in both cases is responsibility. And it's right in the book. In the mid-80s, when we were really kind of beginning to feel our oats and results, we would walk up to the cockpit and notice there's nobody up there.
Yeah.
And that we need to do our homework so we can give instructions to get this thing on the right course.
Yeah, to kind of flip Pogo on his head. We have seen the future, the potential, the opportunity. Yeah. And it is us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, at the CCL conference yesterday, the founder said, you know, I used to thought like the big shots were going to handle the important stuff.
No.
Everyone in that room is clear. They're not.
It's the volunteers.
Exactly. But then we need to then do our homework and get with an organization that can help us do our homework.
There you go. Sam Daly Harris's book, Reclaiming Our Democracy. And the website is citizenempowermentandtransformation.org. Thank you, Sam.
Great. Thanks so much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
citizenempowermentandtransformation.org. Check it out. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Fred in Atlanta, Georgia. It almost looks, from what I see on the screen here, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network, that you want to echo what Sam was just saying.
I haven't been paying real close attention. I was actually sort of, my blood boiled when the man called an hour or so ago saying Arabs don't have a right to live in Israel.
Right.
Like, and that got me thinking about stuff I've wanted to talk with you about for a while. I agree with you on most things, Tom, but sometimes I hear so much Americanism, and I think, we are riding the globe. And now I remember what Tim was saying earlier, that, you know, we're all in this thing together. And when we draw lines, whether it's the 49th parallel, it's artificial stuff. And I think we really need to, like PPP, I want workers everywhere to benefit, not just American workers.
Right. Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm of the opinion, and feel free to contradict me or argue with me about it if you want, But I'm of the opinion that in the United States, our first priority should be American workers. In Mexico, their first priority should be Mexican workers. In Costa Rica, their first priority should be Costa Rican workers. And this globalism makes the first priority none of the workers, but instead the global elites.
Well, and that's the effect that it has.
Right.
The problem is that when the elites can separate the global workers, then we can sort of fight with at the worker level, competing viciously, and the benefits go to those people who set us up.
Right, and that's my problem with these trade deals. You know, we used to have a trade policy that was America first, and we no longer do, and we no longer make things in this country. We don't make the things that are critical to us on so many different levels. We invent them here, but we don't make them here. And increasingly, we're not even inventing them.
Yeah, well, and certainly we're having issues in that sense. But then when these deals come along, the way they are structured is so that corporations, the elite, if you will, can go to Vietnam and pay a worker 65 cents an hour.
Right.
Instead of paying that worker a living, decent wage. And in fact, I would like, and this is, I'm a little bit weird, I guess, but I would like to see the Vietnamese manufacturing cars and the South Americans manufacturing stuff for themselves, because I think that with some of the trade makes for inefficiency. How much energy is wasted transporting stuff.
This is how bizarre it's gotten. Fred, I totally agree with you. This is how bizarre it's gotten. Chicken producers in the United States, chicken farmers, are taking chickens. They slaughter them, but they don't pluck them. They put them on a boat and ship them to China, where Chinese labor then plucks the chickens, de-skins them, does whatever you do to chickens, and then ships them back here wrapped in plastic, you know, ready for the meat store, you know, for the meat counter in the store. And it's like,
yes.
Can you imagine the amount of diesel fuel that is shipping that chicken all the way to China? I mean, it's 6,000 miles away and back.
Tom, chickens are light. I saw this old house showed years ago where they took fuel radiators out of a house in Massachusetts and crushed it or whatever, put it on a boat, shipped it to Japan where they made a car to send back to the U.S.
Right, exactly. When Reagan came into office, we were the major importer of raw material and exporter of finished goods in the world. We are now the major exporter of raw materials, wood and coal mostly, and importer of finished goods in the world. It's wrong. Fred, thank you. Fine, then it's past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Gary in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Gary, you had a question about Fast Track, the TPA?
Yes. Tom, first of all, I want to say you've given me great inspiration. I've been calling the senators as well as the representatives earlier when we needed to call the representatives. I called all the senators yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Good on you.
Pardon me?
I said, good on you.
What I want to know and clearly understand is what exactly happened. You mentioned there was some type of a filibuster or something that the
yes.
Democrats did that sounded like it turned out now they needed fewer votes to pass.
No, here's how it works. When something goes through the Senate, first, it has to come to the floor of the Senate, and there's a vote to consider or something like this, a vote to open the debate. And if somebody objects to that, that's called a filibuster, and they can say, I object. And to overcome that objection, instead of, so there's 100 people in the Senate, instead of 50 votes, which is what you know, majority rules, you need 60 votes to overcome that filibuster. So they got the 60 votes. And they had the debate. And then when the debate is done, then they have to have a motion to, I think it's reconsider or close debate, end debate, a motion to end debate. And the motion to end debate, some Democrat, I don't know who it was, said, no, I don't want to end the debate on this. And, you know, let's just leave it going forever. Let's not have a vote. And so because of that objection by a Democrat, there was, or more than one, probably, they had to have 60 votes to overcome that. They got the 60 votes. Now, the final vote is just going to be a vote, and you can't filibuster the vote. You can only filibuster the debate. And so the vote will be held tomorrow, and they only need 50 votes to make it happen. Am I making sense? The Senate processes are weird and Byzantine, but this is like kind of how it works.
So they need 50 or 51% to approve it.
Well, they'll need... they really only need 50 votes, because if they had 50 votes for and 50 votes against, Joe Biden would be the one who breaks the tie, and he represents Barack Obama, okay. President Obama, who is in favor of this. So they really only need 50 okay. votes.
Well, I appreciate the clarification, and you have truly been an inspiration. I called the 28th District here in Tacoma, and I'm going to start going to their meetings. I want to see both Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, somebody go up against them. I totally support the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I don't support the corporatists. And I believe if you don't support, I think it was Franklin Roosevelt and also Teddy Roosevelt both said that if people don't make a living wage, they're basically slaves.
Yes, Teddy Roosevelt called it the Square Deal. Franklin Roosevelt called it the New Deal. But it was all about you should not, if you're working, in Teddy Roosevelt's case, it was a 50-hour work week. In Franklin's, it was 40. If you're working a 40-hour or 50-hour work week, you should not be living in poverty. You should be able to raise a family. And we've played on the air here numerous times Teddy Roosevelt's comments on that and Franklin's. I won't redo that now. But, yeah, I'm with you. By the way, Shano just said you're our caller of the day to receive a free copy of one of my books. Would you like a book, Gary?
Absolutely.
Okay. Let me put you on hold. Danielle, Gary is on line 8, and you can get his you can figure out which book he wants, and you can get his address information. Shirley in Farwell, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Shirley, what's up?
Hello, Mr. Hartman. I come to a conclusion of what the corporations have become.
Okay.
They have become just like parasites. A parasite will live off a host, don't care if the host lives or dies. And they have not only done it in our country, when they went to Mexico, is Mexico better off now? No.
Right.
What are they doing to China? They're exploiting China. So that's what I've come to the conclusion. Many of the rich, they've all become parasites, living off of us or whoever they can live off of, giving nothing and taking everything. And in the end, what happens to a parasite when they kill the host?
Well, they either have to find a new host or they die.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, they're willing to destroy the whole world. So, you know, I don't know what you feel about that. I am angry right now. I am so angry. I'm having a difficult time keeping it under, you know.
Well, Shirley, let me add some nuance to what you're saying. I agree with you, first of all. But I would say that it's not corporations and rich people. It is the structure of unregulated and deregulated capitalism, which started in the 1980s with Reaganism. It is this deregulated capitalism that makes it possible for very wealthy people or for big corporations to become parasites. Prior to the 80s, we had rich people and we had big corporations, but they were not parasites, they were symbiotes. A symbiote is something that lives in us that it has a symbiotic relationship with us. In other words, we help each other. We've got bacteria in our gut, for example, that actually, you know, oh, my God, there's bacteria in my gut. No, it's supposed to be there. It helps digest your food. So our food provides a little bit of nutrition to the bacteria. The bacteria, in turn, breaks down the food so that we can more readily absorb it through our intestines. That's a symbiotic relationship. And we used to have a symbiotic relationship with our corporations. Biggest employer in the United States, you know, when I was a kid, was General Motors. And they were paying, in today's dollars, $54 an hour on average. Now the biggest employer, and that's a symbiotic relationship. The workers were doing well, and General Motors was doing well. Now the biggest employer in the United States is Walmart, and they pay their workers on average around $9 an hour. That's a parasitic relationship. I agree with you. So I would say that the reason that the parasites have risen up or the symbiotes have become parasites is because Reaganism changed the rules of business in the United States. And that's why it's so important that we repeal not just the Reagan tax cuts, but all this whole trickle-down economics thing. Blow it out. Shirley,
you're
thank you
listening
for the call.
To the Tom Hartman program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with more of your calls right after the news at the bottom of the hour. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Lenny, listening on 880 AM in Oakland, California. Hey, Lenny, what's up?
Hi. Tom, I love you so.
Thank you.
I have a suggestion that I would like to get your opinion on.
Okay.
I would like to tie a huge infrastructure bill to the TPP, okay, and have the Democrats say that they will support TPP if we pass this huge job-creating infrastructure bill. And I think those two would kind of work together.
I agree with you. Here's the problem. The way that you do that through the legislative process is by what's called an amendment. In other words, you would amend an infrastructure bill to the TPP so that they have to pass, if it passes, it all passes at once, right? And with Fast Track, which was just, the filibuster was just broken in the Senate and the vote's going to be held tomorrow, and they only need 50 votes, so the Republicans are going to push this thing through. With Fast Track, now it is illegal. The members of Congress cannot amend any trade deals that are considered under the rules of Fast Track. And so what you just proposed, today we got a step closer, tomorrow in all probability will certainly be impossible.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I had
it's really good. It's a really great idea, though, Lenny.
And I sent an email over to Pelosi on it. I guess I'm a little bit late. Sorry about that.
Yeah. No, it's a brilliant idea, and it's one of the reasons why Fast Track is so pernicious, is so cancerous, because it prevents amendments to legislation, and so you can't improve the bill, you can't modify the bill. You can't change a single word in it. It comes from the 600 corporate lawyers and gets dropped on the floor of Congress, and they either vote for it or they vote against it, period. They cannot change a single word. And we'll see where this goes, Lenny, but you're on to something. It's just unfortunate that they saw you coming, and that's why the whole Fast Track thing, that's why Richard Nixon came up with Fast Track in the first place back when he was shilling for Pepsi-Cola. And came up with the first Fast Track. Thanks a lot for the call. Andrew in Noakesville, Virginia. Hey, Andrew. You say, I am responsible for the rise of racism in America?
Here's the thing. I don't like living in an echo chamber. I am a moderately conservative person. I was raised by Democrats. And so I always make sure I spend some time watching MSNBC, listening to progressive radio. There's nothing learned when you're just talking to people who are as common thought.
What's your point,
Andrew? My concern is people like you who take disagreements with the president and turn it into claim it to be racism, or disagreement in policy.
Do you think shouting you, a white Southern congressman shouting you lie at the first black African-American president in the history of our country during a State of the Union address, something that has never been done in the history of this country, does not have some racial tinge to it? Do you think that white politicians saying we don't know if this guy is really an American don't have racial overtones?
There are a lot of things that people have said and done that you can point to individuals. First of all, the gentleman who said that actually was born out to be true.
No, it wasn't.
He was. But I'm not here to disclaim policy with you, because we can go around and around and around, and eventually you'll cut me off and then go into a monologue how you beat me on the conversation. But what I'm saying is when somebody says, I disagree with the president, and he's white, and you say, you're a racist,
Andrew, you apparently don't listen to this program enough to know how I respond, because if somebody disagrees with the president, and yes, I am going to cut you off. If somebody disagrees with the president, I'm not going to call him a racist for that. That's stupid. And, you know, I have some pride in my intellect. I don't think I'm that dumb. Robert in Greenville, North Carolina. He, in fact, it's rather insulting to have it being suggested that I'm that dumb. Robert in Greenville, North Carolina. Hey, Robert, you wanted to talk about the conservative flag, or the Confederate flag? I guess it's the conservative flag too. Well, it's the Conservative Citizens Council.
Right. Well, the only reason Governor Nikki Haley and Senators Scott and Graham changed their view on taking the Confederate battle flag down was pressure from Rance Priebus and Sharon Day, the leaders of the RNC, because the problems it's causing their candidates running for president.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, all the news media is making Governor Haley into a political star for doing the right thing, and she was told to do it. It wasn't because of her heart. It's all, you know, Earl Holt, the leader of the Council of Conservative Citizens, who was cited by the shooter, Dylan Roof,
right,
made $65,000 in donations to Republicans. Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, Iowa Rep. Steve King, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake,
Michelle Bachmann,
Romney's 2012 run for president, right, former Minnesota Rep. Michelle Bachmann. And then you have Haley Barbert on Morning Joe today saying he wasn't offended by the Confederate flag. This is the same racist governor who reminds me of Boss Hogg, who said we never had problems with the Klan when I was growing up because the Citizens Council took care of anyone that could get out of line. The all-white Citizens Council was the South answer to desegregation. Their motto, we are proud of our white blood and our white heritage.
Right.
We are against mongrelizers. Now the Citizens Council is called the Council of Conservative Citizens, and there we will not be integrated.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, this is, it's insanity. And people are make it look like all of a sudden the Republicans are now, you know, changing. It's all a game. They're just playing a game because it's so close to the presidential election.
Yeah. That's the bad news, Robert. The good news is that political pressure actually had some effect. You know, yeah, the party leaders, I think the cascade really began when Mitt Romney tweeted out, it's time to take down the flag. You know, he's viewed as, by Republicans, as a serious, solid, relatively independent, moderate voice. And at that point, I think it became almost impossible for any of the serious Republican candidates for president. And by serious, I mean people other than Donald Trump and Mike Huckabee and, you know, the hustlers who are in there to continue to hold to those positions. And you know, Mike Huckabee is still not holding to that position. And I, God only knows what Donald Trump is thinking. But so, you know, on the one hand, yeah, it was a cynical political move. And they're not going to change the Southern strategy. They're not going to stop calling out by dog whistle to white people, white racists. But on the other hand, there was enough public pressure that something changed. And isn't that a good thing, Robert?
Yeah, well, it was the poll said it was 49% against and 49% for. So I mean, I guess we're divided down the middle.
Yeah.
It's the North and South, you know, kind of divided down the middle again.
Yeah.
And Chuck Todd on Meet the Press this past weekend, they were talking about Bernie Sanders, you know, and the crowds he was getting. And but he said something that Ralph Nader at one time had a crowd of over 15,000 when he was running.
Right.
And he said, and he only wound up getting like 2.5% of the vote in the election. So he was basically saying, don't get too excited. Everybody might be getting excited over Bernie, but when it comes right down to it, are you going to vote for Bernie or vote for Hillary?
Right.
But I think this is a different time than when Ralph Nader ran.
Well, and not only that, Bernie's not running as an independent or on a green ticket. Bernie's running as a Democrat, and the Democrats don't get 2% of the vote.
I honestly think Bernie has a chance.
I do, too.
I really do.
I think he has a chance to go all the way and be president of the United States.
I do, too, and I think he's the only one that deserves to be the president of the United States right now that's running.
I agree.
Anyway,
yeah.
I'm frustrated. Like the last caller you had, I don't know how you do it.
Oh,
I swear to God, I don't know how you talk to these people over and over.
Yeah,
I can't take it anymore.
Well, that's
old, I guess, for that.
Yeah, that's it's part of my job description, Robert. So, but thank you very much for the call. A very thoughtful call, and I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Sandy in Des Moines, Iowa, watching us on live stream. Sandy, we got a minute to the break. It's all yours. Sandy? No, Sandy. Okay, let's try Karen, listening on WCPT in Chicago.
Oh, hi. This is Karen. I'm from DuPage County, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to tell you that the progressives have taken over the Democratic Party, building by precinct and getting precinct captains. It's been going on for about 6 years, and one of the issues we're having is the old guard, who have now aligned themselves with the Republicans and are trying to drain us of money. And I wondered if you had any suggestions for how to go forward so that they aren't interrupting the 2016 election like they did in 2014.
I missed a word there, Karen. Who has aligned themselves with the Republicans?
The people who were previously in charge of the party, who did not get any, they had very few.
Oh, interesting. So the old guard Democrats are working against the progressives who are taking over the party. Gee, without knowing more detail, I don't know how to advise you other than just keep moving forward, keep bringing progressives in, keep running for getting people to run for precinct committee chairmen, and keep taking over the party. It's great what you're doing, Karen. Keep it up. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. Welcome back. And let's see here. James watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Oak Harbor, Washington. You wanted to disagree with me and say, God bless Robert E. Lee? Really? James? Either James is muted or he's on line 7. I don't know. We'll see where that goes. Let's try Sandy in Des Moines, Iowa, watching on live stream. Sandy, can you hear me?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Sandy. What's up?
Your guest earlier mentioned Citizens Climate Lobby.
Right.
And I've been to some of their events and presentations, even one with James Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
And I really object to their support of nuclear power, and that it really bothers me that an environmental group is supporting nuclear power.
Does the Citizens Climate Lobby support nuclear power, or have they just had some speakers like James Hansen who support nuclear power?
I believe, their presentation was in favor of nuclear power.
Yeah.
And
that surprises me.
Yeah, me too. I did, and it upsets me.
Yeah,
and Hansen even said that nuclear power was safer than solar power, which I could believe he said.
Yeah, well, Hansen is pretty hysterical right now. I mean, he thinks that we're very, very close to irreversible tipping points, and
mm-hmm.
And so I think he's thinking that nuclear power is better than anything is better than fossil fuels. What he fails to understand, I believe. And or I'm wrong on it. I mean, he's the scientist. I'm just a talk show host. But what I think he fails to understand is how much fossil fuel goes into a nuclear power plant. You've got to build the thing. You've got to make an enormous amount of concrete, which is a very carbon dioxide intensive producing process. You got to make a lot of steel, which takes a lot of energy, which is provided by fossil fuels. And then when you fuel the things with enriched uranium, you've got to mine that uranium out of the ground. You use fossil fuels to do that. You've got to transport it to a place to refine it, which takes fossil fuels. It has to be refined by centrifuge, which takes electricity generated by fossil fuels. And then, you've got to figure out a way to store it afterwards, and that's probably going to take fossil fuels. So there's an enormous amount of fossil fuel input into nuclear power. What was her name? Helen Caldicott was on this program, and she said that the average nuclear power plant does not start producing carbon-free electricity until, as I recall, its ninth or tenth year in operation. And mm-hmm. So you know, solar power, wind power. Yes, you need fossil fuels to make them as well because they, you know, they require technology, right? But yeah. They're much less technology intensive. They're much more, you know, they're being mass produced now in very simple ways, and they don't produce waste that is toxic for a million years. So I can't speak to the Citizens Climate Lobby. I don't know that much about them, and our guest who does is no longer here, so I can't ask. But, you know, I've had James Hansen on this program, and I disagree with him about nuclear power, but that doesn't mean that the other things he says are not brilliant and that I shouldn't allow him to make a presentation on my program. So it may well be that that's the way that they were thinking. I just don't know. Sandy, thanks for the call. I'll have to look into it. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media, your media support group for We the People. And Mark in New York City. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great.
There's one thing that's been really bothering me about this whole TPP fiasco in the making, and that is why this is considered an agreement and not a treaty. I mean, it seems like such an important thing for the whole world. If it were a treaty, it would need 66 votes
in the Senate,
two-thirds.
That's correct.
Right. And who is the brilliant guy who changed the wording and made it into an agreement rather than a treaty?
Richard Nixon.
How does that work?
Richard Nixon did. I wrote a piece about it for Alternet, which I don't know if it's up on Alternet now or not, but you might be able to find it. Richard Nixon came up with this idea that and he was doing it as a shill for Pepsi at the time. When he was vice president in 1959, he started shilling for Pepsi. He ended up as president going to China to shill for Pepsi. In 59, he went to Russia or the Soviet Union to shill for Pepsi. We don't know if he was being bribed under the table the way the Milk Producers Association gave him $500,000 in cash, just brought it into the Oval Office and handed it to him to get him to raise milk price supports. But whether he was bribed or whether it was just, you know, he just loved Pepsi. In fact, he was in Dallas the day before JFK was assassinated with the president of Pepsi. And there are some, you know, conspiracy theorists who think he was there to set up the Kennedy killing. No, he was there to set up the killing of the American middle class. So Nixon knew that giving most favored nation status to China would be a very difficult thing to do. So he came up with this thing called Fast Track, where it's like, okay, we're going to negotiate a trade agreement. It's not going to be a treaty because it's going to be limited to business between corporations and corporations, and the government isn't going to be all that involved in it other than just setting the rules for it. There's a whole rationale for it. I believe they are treaties and that they should require, you know, the Constitution says treaties are negotiated by the president and require a two-third vote of the Senate. I believe that these have all been treaties. The NAFTA was a treaty. The Colombia Free Trade Agreement was a treaty. The Peru Free Trade Agreement was a treaty. The South Korean Free Trade but none of them were pushed through as treaties. In every single case, they were pushed through as, quote, trade agreements, which only require a majority vote in the House and the Senate. And I think
that's like on the same level as, like, saying given Congress, Congress has the power to declare war. But yet we've had all these wars since the left.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Vietnam was a conflict, not a war. Therefore, it didn't.
Conflict, not a war.
Yeah.
So is this by executive order?
No. All of Congress was complicit in it. It was basically the Republican Party's efforts to satisfy the Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So one other point, Tom, that I think I called a couple weeks ago, but I didn't get on. In terms of these mergers and acquisitions you were talking about a couple weeks ago,
yeah,
and where all this money is coming from, this vast pool of money.
Right.
Well, I think all you got to do is look at the policy of the Fed with the quantitative easing and all that zero interest money.
You're exactly right, Mark. These mergers and acquisitions are being funded with low cost debt. And that's the problem, because these companies are just taking on enormous amounts of debt. The executives are walking off with hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in many cases. They're making out like bandits. The stockholders are doing well because the value of the stock goes up, as the, particularly with the stock buybacks, but the mergers also. But workers are losing their jobs as a consequence of it. And when the Fed starts raising interest rates, and it's not an if, it's a when the Fed starts raising interest rates, these companies are going to have a hard time servicing that debt. And you're going to start seeing a wave of disintegrations, bankruptcies, companies spinning pieces off, you know, consolidating all the debt into one company and taking, you know, the good companies off of that and then letting that one company go down. I mean, we've seen this before. This is cyclical. We've seen this happen before. And that's how it's going to play out. And it'll probably provoke a crash. It'll probably provoke a real disaster. And it's one of the reasons why the whole world holds its breath every time the Fed meets, you know, if, in fear that they might even raise interest rates, you know, at 10th of a point. You know, it's just because this could be the beginning of the end of the cheap mergers and acquisitions. But the debt is still around. We're addicted to debt. Mark, thank you for the call. Tosh in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Tosh, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my phone call. I just wanted to say this treachery act, treason that the South has been doing for a long time, and we've never called it. The United States is scared of it. We've never dealt with the issue. And we continue to just kick the can down the road. And secondly, I mean, when we defeated Germany on the Nazis, did we allow them to keep their flag up over Germany?
No.
Absolutely not.
Right.
We did not. And there's no reason for it. And that symbolizes the divide, the hurt, and all these other agony things that came along with that civil war.
Yeah. Here's the difference, Tosh, between what happened in Germany and in Japan and what happened in the United States of the Civil War. In Germany and Japan, you had death cults, and they were cults. The Hitlerism was a cult. Tojoism was a cult. Emperor worship was a cult. And you had these death cults where, you know, the Japanese soldiers or pilots would fly right into the decks of American ships. You had the Nazis, you know, with ethnic cleansing and all this stuff. After the war, in both Germany and Japan, the people woke up from the trance of the cult, right? They got decultified, deprogrammed. In the South, the white Southern slaveholders and those who benefited from slavery, they lost the war, but they never got deprogrammed. Today, to this day, the mentality of slavery continues to live in the South. Paul Krugman did a brilliant piece about this in the New York Times yesterday. And he didn't use the language that I'm using, but if you read his piece, you will get it, that he's saying the same thing. That in the South, that's where you find the right to work for less. That's where you find the antipathy toward unions. That's where you find that they don't want to raise the minimum wage. That's where you find they don't want to help poor people out by expanding Medicare. Why? Because they still have this mentality of at least the white middle class and upper middle class power structure in the South still has that plantation slash concentration camp mentality. And that's what's going on. And we need to deprogram the South. They need to go through the same. Thank you, Tosh, for the call. They need to go through that same awakening that the average German did after World War II. And they said, holy cow, our government was nuts and so were we. Or the average Japanese after World War II. Holy cow, our government was nuts and so were we. People in the South have not yet come. White people in the South have not yet come to that realization. I think we're moving in that direction, though. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.